Today is Tuesday, July 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a wave of coronavirus study results spring cautious optimism for a potential vaccine.
We now need to move into larger scale real world trials, but it is good to see more data and more products moving into this very important phase.
Tears in the halls of Congress and across the nation over the passing of an American civil rights icon.
We are one people, one family, the human family. We all live in the same house, the American house.
Also ahead, Beyoncé's brand new visual album celebrating Black Lives is about to drop. It's all on today's International Edition. The World Health Organization is expressing hope for positive progress on research into vaccines to counter COVID-19. WHO's head of emergencies program, Mike Ryan, welcomed news that AstraZeneca's experimental vaccine developed with Britain's Oxford University produced an immune response in early stage clinical trials in healthy volunteers. But Ryan warned there's still much work to be done.
This vaccine was given to 1,000 healthy adults between the ages of 18 and 55 and certainly did not appear to have any serious adverse events other than the expected, in some cases, chills, muscle aches, headaches. And the vaccine did generate neutralizing antibody, I think, in all participants. And in a very small number of participants that were given a booster dose, those responses were even greater. But again, there is a long way to go. These are phase one studies. We now need to move into larger scale real world trials, but it is good to see more data and more products moving into this very important phase.
Ryan told a media briefing in Geneva Monday there are 23 potential vaccines in development. In the same briefing, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that in the meantime, the world needs to continue fighting this virus.
With strong leadership, community engagement, and a comprehensive strategy to suppress transmission and save lives, COVID-19 can be stopped. We do not have to wait for a vaccine. We have to save lives now. Make no mistake, we must continue to accelerate vaccine research while doing more with the tools we have at hand.
Global infections stand at more than 14.5 million, with more than 600,000 deaths. The U.S. continues to lead the number of fatalities. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported an increase of 63,000 new cases, with the state of Florida now a major hotspot for the outbreak. On Monday, the state reported over 10,000 new infections of COVID-19 for a sixth day in a row. From presidents to those he paved the way for, tributes are pouring in for civil rights icon and longtime Congressman John Lewis, who died Friday of pancreatic cancer. Lewis often said the fight for what is right is not always easy. Recently, he was concerned about progress potentially being reversed in the current political climate.
I got arrested 40 times during the 60s, beaten, left bloody and unconscious. But I'm not tired, I'm not weary, I'm not prepared to sit down and give up. You cannot stand by. You cannot sit down. You got to stand up, speak out, and get in the way. Make some noise.
I know racism when I see it. I know racism when I feel it. And at the highest level of government, there's no room for racism.
We have made progress, but there are new forces trying to take us back, trying to turn back the clock, trying to take us to a darker time.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Monday choked back tears as she addressed Congress.
The chair asks that all those present in the chamber, as well as members and staff throughout the Capitol, and all who love John Lewis, wherever you are, rise in a moment of silence in remembrance of the conscience of the Congress, the Honorable John Lewis.
Lewis's colleague, Representative Karen Bass, in an interview on ABC's This Week on Sunday, spoke of the enormity of losing John Lewis.
The nation lost an icon. The House lost the most respected member of the House of Representatives. And the Congressional Black Caucus lost a member of our family.
Human rights group Amnesty International is concerned about police brutality and racism in the U.S. city of Portland, Oregon. Oregon's attorney general is suing the U.S. Department of Homeland Security after the Trump administration deployed federal agents against the wishes of local authorities. VOA's Jason Patinkin in Washington spoke to Amnesty researcher Brian Kastner in Buffalo, New York, about what they're looking into and what their concerns are.
We're watching a few things in Portland. One is arbitrary arrest and arbitrary detention from federal officers that pull up to a crowd and put people in a van and take them away. Second one is the use of these less lethal weapons, how they're using tear gas, how they're using pepper spray, how quickly that they use those two, and then also the use of kinetic impact projectiles, as they're often called, these 40 millimeter rounds. The one case where a person was really significantly injured, he was standing in the street, he had his hands up, he was holding a speaker above his head when he was shot in the face. And if you're shot in the face or head, it can kill you, it can cause life-changing injuries. The third thing that we're watching that we've seen very recently is some medics being picked up and beaten and harassed. And these people are, you know, identified by red crosses on their backpacks or on their shirts. They're volunteers. They're not part of any particular organization, but you see them in protests around the world, people who show up and just want to help whoever happens to be injured. And we've seen some videos now of these medics, you know, just being harassed, beaten, chased away from the protest areas by camouflaged officers that we assume are federal, but hard to know when they're not identifying themselves and not marked.
Looking specifically at these arrests by camouflaged men, what was your initial reaction to seeing those videos?
My initial reaction would be that in another context, they look like disappearances or kidnappings. And in Oregon, I mean, there is a history of far-right groups dressing up in body armor and camouflage and carrying many of the same weapons. And so I think when protesters are saying that, you know, people dressed and armed a certain way come and get them, and they're not read their rights in the United States, they have Miranda rights, they're called, that police need to identify themselves and say why they're under arrest. And so when people are simply picked up, I think it's reasonable to ask, well, who is the group picking me up? And it's taken a few days for journalists to be able to figure out who some of these organizations are.
Now, these federal agents who Trump has deployed are supposedly there to protect a federal courthouse, which has been vandalized by protesters. Is that justification for the use of force that we've seen from these federal agents?
So no matter what their mandate is from the federal government and what they're supposed to protect or how far out from a building their jurisdiction goes, none of that to me is as important as the fact that the mandates around use of force and what is excessive and what isn't, and the fact that excessive use of force is unlawful, that is the important thing. So whether they're inside a federal building, outside of a federal building, those use of force guidelines apply no matter what. And putting graffiti on a wall is not justification for use of force, for, you know, for shooting somebody in the head with a less lethal 40 millimeter round. The fact that it's past curfew is not a justification for shutting down a protest and calling it a riot. It's not like your human right to freedom of assembly or your human right to protest goes away because of some paint on a wall or because a certain hour on the clock was hit.
Last of all, the authorities in Portland and the authorities in Oregon have told the federal forces to leave. They've demanded that the Department of Homeland Security and the Trump administration pull these federal agents out of Portland and out of Oregon. But the Trump administration and the Department of Homeland Security have refused. What do you make of this?
Yeah, that's very worrying. And I would say in other contexts or in other countries and other parts of the world, when local security forces potentially are getting ready to clash with federal security forces, that's when really social order can break down and there can be a really big problem. So in other countries, you know, this would cause us grave concern. It causes us the same concern in the United States And if we're in a position where the Oregon National Guard feels in conflict with the Border Patrol or other federal agents, that is just a real recipe for trouble. And you know, we would urge, you know, the government to sort itself out and not put any of the security forces or more importantly, the citizens on the street to be put in the position between these groups.
Amnesty International researcher Brian Kastner speaking with VOA's Jason Fitzinken. President Donald Trump on Monday threatened to send federal agents to other cities as well. President Trump says he will not publicly commit to accepting November's election results. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
This was Donald Trump 4 years ago while trailing Hillary Clinton in the polls and refusing to say if he'd honor a Clinton win.
I will tell you at the time. I'll keep you in suspense.
He's again behind in the polls to Joe Biden and again refusing to commit to honoring the results.
I have to see. No, I'm not going to just say yes. I'm not going to say no. And I didn't last time either.
After the president's statement on Fox News Sunday, the Biden campaign said the government's perfectly capable of escorting trespassers out of the White House. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Cameroon's medical authorities say over 200,000 children have not received routine vaccinations on schedule since March, when the country had its first case of COVID-19. Parents are refusing to take their kids to hospitals because they fear they may be infected with the virus, which has spread to nearly 17,000 people and caused nearly 400 deaths. Doctors are warning that without the vaccination, children in Cameroon risk preventable diseases such as measles and whooping cough. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
A four-month-old baby cries as she receives her second polio vaccine at the Chantal Biya Foundation Hospital in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. 27-year-old Elizabeth Mbungong says she is getting her baby's booster shot nearly 3 months late because she was scared of going to the hospital during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I gave birth in the month of March. And the first vaccine was given to the baby against tetanus. They gave me another rendezvous in the month of April. I did not respect because I was afraid of the coronavirus.
Mbungong said after she watched a TV program on the dangers of not vaccinating children, she decided that going to the hospital was worth the risk. Pediatrician Clemence Vukmo says many parents are letting fear of the virus prevent them from getting their children vaccinated. She says Chantal Biya Foundation Hospital should have had 2,300 children for routine vaccinations since March, but they have seen only about half the children. Cameroon's medical officials say the problem has been widespread during the pandemic. Cameroon's National Expanded Program for Immunization reports across the country at least 200,000 children have not received their vaccinations as scheduled. Deputy Permanent Secretary of the program, Shalom Chokfe, says they have deployed staff to look for the children. He spoke via telephone from Douala, a coastal city and the largest in Cameroon.
48,000 to 54,000
Chokfe says the situation is especially troubling in the capital Yaoundé, the economic hub Douala, and the western town of Bafoussam. He says 110,000 children in those cities have not received their routine vaccines since the month of March, when Cameroon reported its first case of COVID-19. Teams can meet the children in their houses, says Chokfe. Parents and health workers are safe during routine vaccinations at hospitals, he says, as long as they wear their mask and wash their hands regularly. Chokfe notes that vaccinations dramatically reduce child mortality and urges all parents to get their infants vaccinated on schedule. The United Nations warned this month of an alarming decline in the number of children getting vaccinated for preventable diseases such as diphtheria, tetanus, and the measles. According to a study published by the Lancet Global Health Journal this month, continuing with routine immunizations may lead to 8,300 additional deaths in Africa from COVID-19. But the study said suspending vaccinations could lead to a further 702,000 African children dying from preventable diseases. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Lebanese are battling hunger and deep poverty as their political leaders wrangle with the International Monetary Fund over badly needed reforms to secure a $10 billion initial bailout to redress the nosediving economy. The price of bread, a basic staple in Lebanon, has risen for the first time in 8 years. It's the latest troubling sign that the sectarian, diverse Mediterranean countries' financial crisis is spinning out of control.
Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Many Lebanese are resorting to growing their own vegetables, bartering clothing and furniture, and in some cases stealing, just to feed their children. Dramatic public suicides are more frequent. Analysts say that at least 50% of the population has fallen into poverty, and that the number could top 75% by year's end due to the currency collapse, inflation, and unemployment. The Lebanese pound has lost 80% of its value since October. Accusations of mismanagement and corruption have plagued the government. President Michel Aoun has said a forensic audit of the central bank's accounts is necessary to fight corruption. Jihad Azur directs the International Monetary Fund's Middle East Department. He says the IMF team trying to negotiate with Lebanon's government for more than 2 months believes there's no more time to waste on starting reform measures to protect the most vulnerable.
The acute financial crisis has led to a severe social situation with a level of inflation that is unsustainable. What is needed is unity of purpose, as our managing director said, behind those reforms, moving fast and regaining confidence, because where you start first is to regain confidence.
The United States is the largest donor to the IMF. Washington would like any bailout funds to be conditioned on power held by Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed Shiite militia, which is in government and parliament, to be diminished. The United States classifies Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Lebanon's powerful Catholic cleric, Cardinal Bashar Rai, has accused political leaders of plunging the nation into economic ruin and potential famine with their handling of the crisis. He has called for Lebanon's neutrality in sermons, seen as an implicit criticism of Hezbollah and its support for Iran in conflicts with Gulf Arab states and elsewhere. Speaking in an economic forum sponsored by the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, where he is a director of studies, former Jordanian Foreign Minister Marwan Bouasher warns that Lebanon's political forces are postponing the inevitable reforms required to tackle the country's worst economic crisis since the 1975-1990 civil war.
They cannot go on with business as usual. The international community has a responsibility to help Lebanon. But the Lebanese themselves have the biggest responsibility to understand that they are not just protecting their country, but they're protecting the diversity in the region. I hope that the political forces in the country wake up before it's too late.
Washer says Lebanon is one of the last places in the region where political, cultural, and religious diversity has been exercised. But if that is lost, he added, it won't only affect Lebanon, but the whole Middle East. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has said that Lebanon would look to China for help. But later he said that Hezbollah would be open to receiving help from the U.S., despite calling it an enemy of Lebanon. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
As the COVID-19 pandemic rages on, the world has seen the dangerous potential of this deadly disease, but the unseen consequences are also taking a toll on those who may not have lost a loved one or even become ill. Fear, isolation, and other impacts of the novel coronavirus have created widespread anxiety, PTSD, and other mental health issues. However, in parts of Africa and the United States and elsewhere, mental illness is stigmatized, and treatments from medicine to therapy are badly under-resourced. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Yuval Nuria, a medical psychology professor at Columbia University Medical Center, who also conducted research on epidemics and mental health in the U.S. and West Africa during the 2016 Ebola outbreak.
In the context of a virus like the coronavirus, you need somebody who will know about trauma, about fear, and for family members who unfortunately lost someone, you need an expert in bereavement and how to help people go through bereavement in a good way, in an effective way.
What do mental health professionals actually do during their sessions? What's their goal?
What mental health experts are doing, they are establishing contact with people who is struggling to talk through the experience instead of bury the experience inside because of shame or guilt or sense of failure and get the people feeling that they are not alone.
Many people do feel very alone these days, what with quarantining and social distancing and masks.
Absolutely. You know, human beings are social creatures, but COVID really separated us from our families, from our loved ones. Luckily, some of us have the internet, but you cannot touch your children via the internet. You cannot hug them. They cannot do that to you. But I would say in general that keeping the social network active in times of stress and trauma and death is so important, you know, not letting people feel deserted and abandoned. So maintain social relationships, either by phone or video or physically. We must do that.
But as a mental health expert, you found that online counseling during COVID has really been helping.
We at Columbia University Medical Center, we are coming out now with a number of solutions, and it's going pretty well. We didn't stop treatment for people who need us. We actually transitioned from face-to-face meetings, and that's worked pretty well for us.
And as you discovered during your recent trip to Kenya, more and more people on the continent are online via their smartphones. That's good for medical help as well as mental health counseling too.
Exactly. This is so important because if we can transmit medical information about pandemic, we can also address depression and anxiety, which is always the case when you have a crisis. The first period is really about high adrenaline and how to survive. But the second and the third stages are always about grief and mental health problems that are rarely addressed. And a crisis like this provides both tangible losses. You can lose a family member, your salary, but also intangible losses. That is really about, you know, who you are as a person who loves music, loves to go out, loves to go to baseball or basketball. Something that is extreme grief about our identity kind of changing rapidly because of such a massive crisis.
Yuval Nuria, medical psychology professor at the Columbia University Medical Center, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. As we talked about earlier in the show, the man known as the conscience of Congress and revered civil rights icon, Representative John Lewis, died on Friday. In 2013, Lewis said that Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks were two of his biggest heroes who have inspired him throughout his life.
These two individuals inspired me to find a way to get in the way, to get in trouble. And I got in trouble. Good trouble.
We hear more from director of the Magnolia Pictures film, John Lewis, Good Trouble, Don Porter. Tell us what it was like spending a year with him making this film and what you want people to take away about John Lewis, the man.
One of the things I wanted to do with this film was to make sure people understand that John Lewis is a living, breathing, working person, and he is not a postage stamp. He should not become calcified in history. And it was important to me to show how his activism has continued and grown and evolved and changed. And I would like people to think of that. He certainly could have said, I have done enough. I have done enough for all of you. And instead, he did the opposite. He said, how can I do more? How can I make sure that the laws of this country are fair to the people with the least power? And I found that very moving, that this really is his life's work. I think that one of the lessons that John Lewis so beautifully exemplifies for us is that we have different callings at different times of our life.
Clearly, he's so beloved. You could visibly see that every step of the way in this film. Revered, respected, and a sense of humor, a sense of authenticity. I think is valuable to just, he is a civil rights icon and he is also now a politician to some degree, but he's also, as you said, a real person doing things. What does it say about how far we've come and how much John Lewis has done and what we've seen in the past months?
I think the tragic period, visible, continued police violence and other racist acts remind us painfully, heartbreakingly, that we must be vigilant. I think, and I include myself in this, that when President Obama was elected, I felt a sense that there had not only been change, but there had been real change, that his election was also emblematic of our collective evolution. And I do think that that is still the case, but I also think to some extent it meant we weren't seeing what we didn't want to see. It was easier to ignore casual racism and homophobia and sexism. That was a mistake. The lesson John Lewis teaches us is progress is a long road and that you must remain constant and committed.
He seemed to repeat over and over, we do not have time for despair. We need to keep going. It's not time for despair. It's time for action. I mean, that really resonated throughout the film. That is what he wants.
That is exactly what he wants. So I spent the better part of a year interviewing him, going places with him. And there were times when I would say, Mr. Lewis, this thing upset me or that thing upset me. And he was always counseling me about just the thing that you're bringing up. I think to some extent, his message is don't focus on the other folks that, you know, kind of examine your own behavior. And John Lewis is a person who lives his values. And for that reason, he's a very peaceful, optimistic person. You know, sometimes you don't want to meet the people that you admire because you don't want them to ruin it for you.
Right.
And I do not have that problem with John Lewis because he is such a gentle, peaceful person that it's almost hard to reconcile his fierce, steely spine. And to know that these qualities exist in the same person really, really affected me. I think that he's so peaceful because he's not compromising. He talks about living without fear. That has like freed him, living without fear. And, you know, so one of the things I've been thinking is, you know, we all don't have to march on the bridge. We all don't have to confront the police, but we can think about what we can do. And what if we did live our lives without fear? What if we didn't worry if it would offend somebody, if we called out their racism or their sexism or their homophobia? What if we weren't quiet when those things happened? Perhaps they wouldn't percolate to become this virulent, overpowering force that they seem to be right now. So that's one of the things that I have taken away from my time with him, which has been a very, very important and meaningful experience for my life. He's still protesting, but he's also doing the politics. He's always looking for a way for lasting change.
Dawn Porter, director of the Magnolia Pictures film, John Lewis, Good Trouble. John Lewis did have a chance to see the film several weeks ago and gave his thumbs up approval. Beyonce's long-awaited new visual album, Black is King, will premiere July 31st on Disney Plus and on the African continent, but a sneak peek is available in a just-released trailer. The visual album is described as being designed as a celebratory memoir of the Black experience based on music from The Lion King, The Gift. The trailer reveals that the film's guest stars will include Beyonce's husband and rapper Jay-Z, Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o, supermodel Naomi Campbell, and recording artists Pharrell Williams and Kelly Rowland. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.